space. We're told it's quite large. These are the voyages of the starship Nighthawk. Its continuing mission to explore strange new barbecue. To seek out new pie and movie conversation, to boldly opine like many have done before. Mr. Foster, do we have any music that's more iconoclastic?
Okay, this is yet another episode of Nighthawks that has nothing to do with Orson Scott Card. 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Nighthawks Diner. Glad you could join us. I hope you're hungry. We got some tender vittles for you today.
Some tender vittles in space.
This is the Nighthawks podcast. I'm Trevor T. Trujillo, one of your hosts for this particular podcast. And joining me in the diner today is my co-host, Matt Foster. Matt, how are you?
I'm all right.
I said your name this time, and you weren't expecting it.
I'm getting over. I'm a little froggy, so people have to bear with me. I've had a scratchy throat for a bit. Had to have a lot of Bigelow sleepy time tea and try to get over it.
Yeah, Matt. Matt's got a little of the Michigan J going in his little old throat. That was unnecessary. So, ladies and gentlemen, here at the Nighthawks Diner, at the Nighthawks Podcast, we like to talk about movies, and that's what we're going to do today. So join us at the table, and we are going to be discussing the 1999, I'd say for the majority of the time between now and then, it's been oft overlooked. I think it's finally found some revisits and some people rediscovering it once it hit a few streaming platforms. And I think it's been refreshed in the cultural mind. But we're talking about 1999's Galaxy Quest, the sci-fi spoof movie. I feel uncomfortable calling it that because that almost feels like you're doing it a disservice.
That's kind of what we wanted to talk about when we originally formulated this episode notion, is like kind of what maketh a parody and what separates a good one from, say, a what's-her-name's one.
Those guys who make those movies with the generic titles and the very literal humor.
Not another hacky, belabored movie.
All right. Well, the movie was released Christmas of 1999. The three main build stars, we're looking at Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver, and Alan Rickman, although we'll get to the rest of the cast in a minute. And boy, does this have a cast. But Galaxy Quest is a film about the cast of a fictional television series of the same name. It's called Galaxy Quest. That either, we're not clear, it either culturally replaced or happened in parallel with shows from the real world like Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica. Galaxy Quest, the show in the movie, is a crew-based science fiction television space opera where the actors played out adventures that mostly took place on the bridge of a starship or a soundstage that was obviously dressed up like an alien world or the recognizable landscapes of the deserts around Southern California. Basically, we're looking at Star Trek. Galaxy Quest was a... they're using it to play in the Star Trek oeuvre without actually calling it out Star Trek by name. The cast of this TV series, 30 years removed from the show, is squeaking out a living. They're kind of forgotten and sometimes burdened with typecasting. They're making out a living on the convention circuit. The show's lead, Captain Kirk, kind of William Shatner analog, is played by Tim Allen, and he's this egotistical ass. He's late for his calls. He abandons his co-stars to freelance. And the cast and him are really growing weary of the convention circuit and kind of their niche fame And so because of this, Alan's character is having a crisis. But when he gets mixed up with a race of real aliens who have intercepted the television show broadcasts and taken them for fact, he kind of bumbles his way and gets the cast involved into a real life version of the TV show and an intergalactic battle for supremacy.
In the far reaches of the galaxy, a civilization is under siege.
We are all that is left.
They've searched the universe for a leader.
Stay tuned for scenes from next week's Galaxy Quest.
Never give up. Never surrender.
He will save us.
What they got.
Never give up and never surrender.
We're struggling TV actors.
You are our last hope.
Where's my limo?
Okie dokie.
And they're about to put on a command performance 8 million light years away.
We are actors, not astronauts.
You are our protectors.
That was a hell of a thing.
So basically, folks, we're looking at the Three Amigos science fiction edition.
I actually legitimately never made that connection before, but you're correct.
So, Matt, how did this one leave you?
This is, I think, one of my faves.
I alluded to this a little bit at the beginning, and I have to cop to the being part of the problem here, in that I saw this movie when it came out in 99, and then never watched it again until, I think, maybe like last year or 2 years ago, and then watched it again and said, man, this was really good. Why haven't I watched this more often? Were you in that camp, or have you always been kind of a perennial fan?
I had a friend in college that probably, I believe, had a movie night with this when it came out on VHS. I didn't see this one in the theater. I mean, I liked it the first time I saw it. I've developed a latter day appreciation of just how deft it is. Obviously, it's a strong ensemble, and they all have either had done or went on to do pretty cool stuff. It is one of those kind of Breakfast Club, Big Chill things you watch and go, man, there's a lot of people in this.
Yeah, we talked about that over the course of the show a couple of times with various different movies. It acutely comes to mind is when we did our Half-Baked episode, talking about all these people who showed up in this one movie and then would later go on to have unrelated, vastly successful careers apart from that. And this is another movie like that. Like I said, we have Tim Allen, Buzz Lightyear, a somewhat controversial figure in Hollywood right now, but fairly well-beloved at this point. I think he was either still working on or had just wrapped up with Home Improvement at this point. Sigourney Weaver, a science fiction queen at this point in her career, doing really well. Alan Rickman as kind of our third lead. And this is really before the world had kind of discovered who Alan Rickman was. Movie fans knew who he was. They knew him as Hans Gruber. But the world hadn't quite discovered Harry Potter yet. He hadn't had that big breakout role that would make him a literal household name. And so this is kind of almost a nascency picture for him, although if you were hip, if you had watched Die Hard and religiously watched it every Christmas, you obviously knew who Alan Rickman was. You also knew him from, like, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, I think was another high-profile movie that would have keyed with viewers at the time. You also have Tony Shalhoub, Sam Rockwell, Daryl Mitchell, as kind of our sub co-stars. These people were not names at all at the time. You also have showing up in this movie Rainn Wilson, Enrico Colantoni, Justin Long, Jeremy Howard, who have all gone on to do big things since then. Rainn Wilson himself, you know him from The Office, and he has gone on and kind of completed the loop. He is the new Harry Mudd on Star Trek Discovery, which is the kind of Star Trek reboot TV series. Justin Long, you know him because he's a Macintosh to the fat and dumpy PC. He was also in Accepted, Drag Me to Hell. Recently, he was in Tusk. Enrico Colantoni, who is fantastic in this. You know him as Veronica Mars's dad. He was in Person of Interest. He's in Powers. Jeremy Howard has done a lot of voice work. He's currently Donatello for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. He was also in Accepted. You saw him in Breaking Bad. really just the cast went from a real nascency project. This was this is probably one of the earliest works you're going to find a lot of these people in, where they're in a role where you can pick them out and say, that is Rainn Wilson. Okay. And they would go on to have these fantastic careers and be very talented individuals.
Yeah, it was one of those, I guess you'd call it a Nexus movie. Partially just because of the construction of the script, it had room in it for people on the way up and mature actors as well. Mm. And what's cool about it is the, I don't know what you'd call them, the kind of Greek chorus of the aliens.
The Thermians is the race of aliens.
They got a lot of quality, you know, a lot of quality time on stage, and they're just a pretty cool variety of people. And they got nicely, I want to say nicely exposed, but phrasing. they got a good day on screen out of it. I think it was one of those springboard movies. And the other thing is, you can just honestly tell that everybody on it had a good time.
Yeah, this movie looked like a blast. I also want to shout out Missy Pyle is in this, and I think she's somebody who probably doesn't get enough credit.
I think she's kind of, I don't know how to put this, she's a little bit typecast as kind of, I associate her with a lot of odd frat girls and mean neighbors and kind of soccer mom type parts. But then you look through her actual credits and she's played a lot of odd things too. Like, she actually takes a lot of monster work. She's just one of those kind of overlooked people, has a lot of credits, has a lot of range. It's almost like half the time you don't see her because she's doing something.
Because she disappears into the role so much, yeah.
Quote unquote out of lane, but not really, because like half of her stuff is out of the lane that made her famous. I would call her like run in the early 2000s, like Josie and the Pussycats, the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory remake.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, Spring Breakdown. That was a good one.
Yeah, and actually her part was one of many, many changes that was made to this script. You know, we often talk about how producer meddling or too many people getting involved will spoil a movie, and that is very often the case. This one, it almost seems to have kind of worked in the movie's favor to have a few more lanes of input. For example, Missy Pyle was supposed to have a much smaller role, but Steven Spielberg, I guess, kind of stopped by and gave the advice that, I really like her, you should give her a bigger part. And so they wrote more scenes in. I think specifically the love story between her character and Tony Shalhoub was added to the script to kind of showcase her a little bit more.
At this point, I can no longer conceptualize Galaxy Quest without. Like, I can't even imagine why there was such a version.
So the movie was originally written on spec. The producers didn't care for the original script. However, Mark Johnson, he was one of the producers on the movie, liked that Three Amigos theme. He liked the idea of the aliens who mistake the television broadcasts for factual document, and commissioned another script to be written.
First draft was very consistent with the action scenes at the end, right? It was darker, grittier than what ended up.
That's the apocryphal story. I have never actually found a definitive kind of oral history of this movie, but that's kind of the idea that I'm led to believe. I think Tony Shalhoub has come out and said he didn't remember a darker version of the movie. However, this movie was heavily, heavily edited. I mean, there are some scenes in here where the ADR is actually quite bad. In one scene, Gwen DeMarco screams the line, "Well, screw that." And it is clearly dubbed that she said something different at that point. In the shooting script, I guess there was definitely more profanity. This was supposed to be a harder movie. It was supposed to be an R-rated film. And another thing they took out is that Tony Shalhoub's character, if you pay attention, kind of pulls this weird turn at the end of like the first act, and he starts acting different. And that was never really understood. And I think there is a throwaway line kind of left in there, leaving you to infer what happened. But he was originally, before everybody gets beamed up to the Thermian ship, was supposed to smoke a joint and then spend the rest of the movie high, which is why he's so much more complacent to everything that's going on than everyone else is.
That was a hell of a thing.
<I don't know. laughs> Yeah, the film originally received an R rating and then got recut so they could get a lower PG-13, which is, again, one of those things that usually happens by committee. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. I think in this case it worked. It made it a little more accessible, a little more general. Some of the other things that kind of changed over the course of this movie as it went from conception to production, it was originally supposed to be directed by Harold Ramis, the late Harold Ramis of Ghostbusters fame. Problems arose. He kind of locked horns over the pick for the lead in the film. Harold Ramis was not a fan of Tim Allen, didn't want him in the role. The producers wanted him in the role. I believe Ramis's pick was Alec Baldwin, was supposed to be the Jason Nesmith character. They ended up splitting ways over the issue. And then Mark Johnson, who is the producer on the film, hired the director who ended up doing it, which is Dean Parasot for the position, and which was kind of fortuitous because that's who Mark Johnson had wanted in the first place.
Like, in hindsight, after watching Baldwin on 30 Rock, he would have been great.
But... Yeah. Well, and then what's funny is that Harold Ramis then went back after seeing the movie and said, yeah, Tim Allen actually surprised him.
This is for the record, the thing in which, of all Tim Allen, this is my favorite Tim Allen product, for
yeah,
sure.
And I think...
By a margin.
You know, I want to throw a shout out to the Toy Story movies, too. Those are pretty endearing and consistent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was editing them out, and you even mentioned them earlier.
So switching gears here, we talk a little bit about the relative success of Galaxy Quest, and it was a modest success. It didn't blow anything out of the water. It didn't, and like I said, it really didn't quite live on past its theatrical run until recently. But just to give you an idea, this was a Christmas release. This is a big release period for studios. And so you'll see some high-profile releases around the same time. We're talking Christmas of 1999. The movie it opened against that was also opening that weekend was The Talented Mr. Ripley. It was likely up against other movies that had opened the week before in December. Any Given Sunday, Stuart Little, the Michael J. Fox family film, and the Andy Kaufman biopic Man on the Moon. And it was also probably up against a couple of movies that had been in the theaters for a couple of weeks at that point, looking at The Green Mile, the Stephen King adaptation with Tom Hanks, and, of course, the seminal work by one Rob Schneider, Deuce Bigalow, Male Gigolo.
That'd be brutal to have to go up against Deuce Bigalow, Male Gigolo.
So, Matt, was it up against too much? Was it a little before its time? Why didn't this movie get talked about, do you think?
I'd say it's kind of too strange of a creature to reach the audience quickly.
And see, what I think is actually kind of brilliant about it, and this is kind of what we wanted to talk about, is that as it functions as a Star Trek, to call it a parody would be disingenuous. I'd call it a Star Trek analog, and they're using that analog as a meta function to kind of explore some of the grander themes and problems around fan culture and around properties like this. So I don't know that parody is the right word, but it functions as a just-to-the-left Star Trek film, but it also functions as a standalone science fiction movie. You don't have to be familiar with the source material in order to enjoy this. So I think it is kind of a weird hole and maybe was marketed a little weird, and I think maybe Star Trek fans keyed into it, but I don't know that it got much beyond that. It kind of just hit as, you know, and this is just my subjective read. I haven't done any kind of box office analysis or anything on this, but I think people just kind of dismissed it as another Star Trek movie.
I don't know. It may not have been clear what it was, and the other thing is the bankability in it kind of vanished in the ensemble, I think. Like, it's kind of not the material that would draw people that just go see things because Tim Allen's in them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure, or it might have appeared the kind of visually, the color palette and stuff of Galaxy Quest is kind of friendly. It may have not appeared quite hardcore enough for the sci-fi fans at the time who were like, you know, that was the year of The Matrix.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it is weird because the 90s had that... sleek, everything is black PVC plastic or leather, everybody's wearing sunglasses. You wanted things to look very sleek and very European, and Galaxy Quest doesn't really have that. They are kind of lodged in a weird, I almost want to say like Star Trek the motion picture era look. the set dressings, the costumes, that type of thing, is from a real specific era. And it's important to note that Galaxy Quest TV series, the fictional series in the movie, does not take place when Star Trek took place historically. Star Trek took place historically in the late 60s, and then Galaxy Quest, in canon, in the movie, is set to have taken place during the early 80s, essentially moving everything up about 20 years, or, you know, 20, 15 years in that neighborhood.
You know, now that I think about it a little bit, I think you're right about it being a little out of time, because the giant con culture and stuff hadn't, cons were much nicher when this came out.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think you're correct. That's probably a big part of it.
And that's one of the centerpieces of this film is kind of how things happen at science fiction conventions. In this case, back in my day, specifically, you would have conventions for one specific property. Yeah, there was, you know, San Diego Comic-Con, and, you know, there were more general conventions, but there were specifically Star Trek conventions. I don't know if they still do that or not, or if they've all just kind of come under the heading of general fan conventions. But this is specifically a Galaxy Quest convention, which in and of itself is kind of a niche property. So not only were cons very niche, this is a niche con in a niche circuit. And so it is much smaller, but what I like is that the problems that they kind of address in some of the commentary that's made about convention culture and things like that is still very valid, and if not more so, in a modern era, especially with the way that conventions have exploded over the last several years. The whole Jason Nesmith being disgruntled about his career and having kind of a career crisis is actually based on a real-life incident. In the movie, Jason Nesmith escapes to a, you know, our stars are big people, we worship at their feet, but they're humans just like anybody else and have to toddle off to the communal bathroom. And while in the stall, Jason Nesmith overhears two people kind of, the two normies, two outsiders who are kind of ragging on him for, come on, get a life, you know, this show happened 20 years ago, you know, you're still riding on it, you're lame, this is weak, he doesn't know what a big joke he is. Well, that actually happened to William Shatner one time in a convention bathroom. And so it's based a little bit on that. And then immediately following, Jason Nesmith goes back out onto the con floor and gets a little curt and testy with some of the people who are standing in line for his autograph. And that is also based on a William Shatner happening where he appeared on an episode of Saturday Night Live. And in a skit, he kind of stood up on the podium and preached, come on, guys, it's just a TV show. Get a life. In the joke of the sketch, they're asking him really granular stuff. What was the combination to the wall safe?
That's where you and the crew of the Enterprise got attacked by these spores and started acting real weird, like hippies and stuff.
Right, I remember. Okay, what's your question?
Well, I wonder if you could settle a bet for me and my friends.
Sure.
Okay, like when you left your quarters for the last time and you opened up your safe, what was the combination?
I don't know. I mean, it's been a long time. I don't know that.
Okay, okay.
Okay? Anybody? Oh, all right. Go ahead. You? Go ahead. You in the funny shirt.
Okay. Okay. Another bet.
Uh-huh.
Okay. On your horse farm, all right, how many saddle-bred horses do you have?
34.
Wait. Is that including the colt that was born earlier this week?
That mare had a foal?
Tuesday.
Well, I guess it's 35 then.
All right.
You know, before I answer any more questions, there's something I wanted to say. I having received all your letters over the years, and I've spoken to many of you, and some of you have traveled, you know, hundreds of miles to be here, I'd just like to say, get a life, will you, people? For crying out loud, it's just a TV show. I mean, look at you. Look at the way you're dressed. You've turned an enjoyable little job that I did as a lark for a few years into a colossal waste of time. I mean, how old are you people? What have you done with yourselves? You must be almost 30. Have you ever kissed a girl?
And ends up going off on these people. Well, it ended up being a really controversial moment where the fans are saying, well, how much of this is the Saturday Night Live skit and how much of this is actual general sentiment from William Shatner? And has he kind of turned his back on the community? And so there is a lot of reality and a lot of culture commentary that's present in Galaxy Quest, and especially if you were contemporary at the time.
Yeah, maybe that's part of it, too. Maybe there is a little note of the anti-fan, pro-fan, you know, scub, anti-scub going on in it. and it's a little schizophrenic on how to resolve it. Like, it does have a little bit of a note of grow up just a little.
It's not necessarily indicative of either one. It's not saying that the fans are too obsessed or that the stars are too distant and too removed, but there is a little of, can you guys meet each other halfway? Because at the end of the movie, Justin Long plays one of the fans, and he actually ends up being a rather pivotal role in the movie, and he and his friends' encyclopedic knowledge of the TV show that the Thermians have based all of their technology on. When we have to figure out where the Doomsday device is in the starship and how to turn it off, you know, those fans come in really handy. Those fans that paid super granular attention to the TV series.
Listen to me. This is Jason Nesmith. I play Commander Peter Quincy Taggart of NSEA Protector. We accidentally traded boxes the other day when we bumped into each other.
Oh, Commander, I see. Okay.
What's your name, son?
Brandon?
Brandon, I remember you from the convention, right? You asked all those little technical questions about the ship, and I was a little short with you.
Yes, I know, Commander, and I actually wanted to tell you that I thought a lot about what you said.
It's okay, now listen.
But I want you to know that I'm not a complete brain case, okay? I understand completely that it's just a TV show.
Hold on.
I know there's no
brain. Wait a minute. Stop for a second. Stop. Wait.
No ship.
It's all real.
Oh my God, I knew it!
So there is a little of that where that pays off, but at the same time, it's about having a relationship and treating these people as real people on both sides of the coin. So on that end, and we've tiptoed around talking about this, and maybe we will have a grander discussion, but just for the sake of this talking about the movie, what do actors owe their fans, if anything, and vice versa? What do the fans owe their actors? Do you have a takeaway for that?
You know, I don't know. I'm a big fan of Never Meet Your Heroes. I think it's a little different if you go to a con because you're on the clock.
Yeah.
So like the behavior that's expected at a con where you've been paid to show up and people are literally handing you money for a little bit of your time is a different standard of behavior than, you know, you're dining al fresco and somebody leans over the fence and says, oh, are you Tom Hanks? Can I have a bite of your burrito? They're slightly different creatures.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know that I would ever, like, I have met people who, when I asked for an autograph or for a picture or something, that said, hey, listen, I'm trying to get out of here in a hurry, and if I stop for you, I've got to stop for everybody. I understand that. Or if they just don't feel like it, or, you know, whatever. I totally get that. I think if I were to stand in line to meet and get a picture with John Q. Actor, I would have certain expectations there where if the picture didn't come out or if I didn't look good, you know, or something along those lines where I'd want some assurance on quality and the nature of the interaction. But at the same time, and this is where my hitch is, in meeting those people in that setup, it feels so professional. It's very businesslike. And I've had so many rewarding experiences just kind of bumping into people out in the wild that it has less of a draw for me. And that seems super elitist to say. And that's why I kind of don't want to address it. But at the same time, it's the truth where 5 minutes of FaceTime for a picture and a handshake for me, and I'm not saying that it has to be this way for anybody else, but for me is just not something that I'm super jazzed about.
I don't get real bound up and into meeting famous people, and I actually almost literally like to regard it as a black box. Like Hollywood just makes the art, and I don't have to know anything about what the people do when they're off duty. And I think that's a it's just a prudent policy. Then I don't have to worry about if they're awful. If I turn the corner and there's a famous person, I guess you have to remark on it, but I'm pretty low key about it. Like, it doesn't bother me too much. I'm happy to have the story to add to my repertoire of amusing stories if I do meet somebody famous. Hopefully one day I'll get as lucky as Tom Segura did when he flew with Mike Tyson. But by and large, I'm just not that I'm not that partial to it. And it's like, it's one of those things where I get some FOMO when people talk about Comic-Con. Like, I'm like, eh, maybe I should go check it out. I pretty much live without regrets when I don't.
Well, so. I don't want to get too hung up on that because I really don't want to bag on cons. And I think that may be a conversation we can have in a full episode. But in regards to Galaxy Quest specifically, speaking of Comic-Cons, in 2013 at the Las Vegas Star Trek convention, so I guess they still do have Star Trek-specific conventions, at least as recently as 4 years ago, Galaxy Quest was included on the fan-sourced Best of Star Trek Films list, and it ranked pretty high. It was like number 6 or 7 or something like that. Yeah, I mean, it was up there. And so how Star Trek is Galaxy Quest? How buried in it is this movie, and how much of it is its own thing? First off, I guess, would you consider this a non-canon Star Trek? Is this the never say never again of the Star Trek universe?
I think that's neat that they honored it that way, but it is still too rooted in parody for me to consider it a non-canonical entry. It's clearly diversified to address certain points in Star Trek directly. But it's also no interlocking Star Trek knowledge required or expected. It's not really Trek, and it's definitely pointed enough at Trek. It's funny they put it on that list, and I get what they were saying, but it's not really, you know? No, I don't think so, not quite.
What I will say is I think Galaxy Quest probably hits the bullseye a little closer and probably feels a little more like Star Trek or like a satisfying Star Trek entry than some of the lesser Star Trek films, say Star Trek V or Star Trek Insurrection. I think it was the third Next Generation film. Probably hits a little closer to what people love about Star Trek than those movies did. So I like that it was included and then it's kind of considered. But yeah, it is its own thing. And I think to firmly bury it in Star Trek parody is a mistake, because I think it does function on its own level as a meta-narrative that I think kind of transcends Star Trek. I think to bury it too fully in the parody realm is a bit of a mistake, and that's kind of why I tiptoed around it at the beginning of the podcast, because you have another example of a film that is solidly a satire and parody in something like Spaceballs, which is a takeoff of Star Wars. Galaxy Quest almost has that extra dimension, that extra meta narrative that is equal parts parody, but is also commentary. They're saying some stuff here. And I think it works better as a standalone movie, whereas Spaceballs is not going to be as funny if you have not seen Star Wars.
You know, that's one of the major points we had bulleted here, and I think it's true. It's the difference between a winking parody like a Spaceballs or Evil Alien Conquers, which is another kind of pretty funny light sci-fi parody, but it's much more reliant on having more fan knowledge. Galaxy Quest does a really good job of exposition. They tell you enough that if you knew nothing about Star Trek, they lay the conventions out very elegantly for you, just in case you don't already know them, and they do it without a hard preach in there, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at Sam Rockwell's character, who is in the movie. Sam Rockwell plays an actor who was on the show one time as an extra in one scene and then died early in the episode. And he's been kind of suckling at that teat for his entire career. And I don't believe his character was even named in the episode. And the actor's name is Guy. So he is just a guy. And so there's, you know, funny commentary and kind of parody elements of him being a Star Trek red shirt, which are the disposable crew members who go down in the away party and do not come back. And I think as a fan, you and I and others like us understand that convention, and it's a funny moment. But when he is having the crisis of realizing that he is a Star Trek red shirt, they explain the convention well enough as he's having that breakdown that somebody who has never seen Star Trek is gonna be able to understand that convention and function with it, even though they don't have firsthand knowledge.
But that, and that's exactly an example of what I was talking about earlier with it being, it's just like a bonus layer for the people that are really into it. I would say the other thing that really makes Galaxy Quest distinct, it has per character plot arcs where everybody grows and changes a little bit. And then it also has an actual dramatic resolution where some things happen, particularly with Alan Rickman's character, where he really changes. Like, his character is this Shakespearean actor, and it's very disappointing to him, which, again, is a little bit of a nod to Alec Guinness.
Well, and it's also a nod to Patrick Stewart, who came up through the Royal Shakespeare Company and, you know, has admittedly took Star Trek as a paycheck, and it became his iconic role.
His sense of humor about working in Star Trek, and just like his good friend Ian McKellen's sense of humor about working in the X-Men, who is another person that really had no business slumming in the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
But they've both, over the course of their careers, really evolved and avoided that Harrison Ford, Alec Guinness, I don't want to talk about that movie kind of trap. Rickman himself, who would then go on to be in Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
so
true.
So in a way, it happened to him in real life after the fact.
Well, and it goes even deeper than that, because Alan Rickman's character in this is supposed to be the token alien on the bridge. And because he is snatched up from a convention where he was appearing in costume, he is wearing his alien makeup throughout the course of the narrative. And, you know, the Thermians don't realize that there's just Alan Rickman underneath this bumpy head makeup job. He's the science officer. He's clearly a Mr. Spock analog. And Leonard Nimoy famously published the book, the memoir, I Am Not Spock, and kind of how the original run of these science fiction idols were not expecting this. They were not signing on for a lifelong role that they had to play and struggled with being typecast about it. And, you know, sometimes got a little raw about it. Now, Leonard Nimoy later recanted and wrote the book I Am Spock. And
reprised his role as that particular Spock in the odd new continuity-shifted Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
The other thing, and, like, the finale of Galaxy Quest revolves around a MacGuffin, which is kind of an allusion to the Genesis device in Star Trek. Again, it's there for you if you need to know it. But then more broadly, most people are well aware that since the original series and Lost in Space, and even some of the Westerns that went before them, there were a lot of deus ex machinas and a lot of MacGuffin-y black boxes that fix the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, there's that nod, but the nod is still accessible. It's both a specific and a general reference.
We talked a little bit about that with Stephen DeGennaro and found footage where he would call out a trope by name, discuss it, and then immediately use the trope, and it's still effective. You're seeing that in Galaxy Quest as well, which is why I consider it more of a meta movie than a satire or a parody. I think that's where I'm kind of landing.
I mean, I would still call it a satire or send up a little bit. It's love and it's insideness. I mean, it's better acted than an episode of what it parodies. It also completely, like Sigourney Weaver's character, who is quote unquote just there to repeat what the computer says, she finds herself in the actual stressful situations they encounter doing it to keep the crew calm and to
and well, and I think it keeps it her calm of, too. She's like, I have one job on this ship and I'm going to do it, you know.
Well, and it kind of points out that some of those tropes come from human tendencies, like as maligned as like the William Shatner kissing the green girl, you know, as much as that. Speaking of, I know we're eventually scheduled to segue into other satires, but the Zap Brannigan Futurama character, where they really play up the worst aspects of Captain Kirk's caddishness, and, you know, but some of those things are tropes for a reason. And what Galaxy Quest does is it manages to, in a very crystalline and granular way, make fun of the trope without ever taking a dump on the audience or the author.
Yeah, that's true.
Not just the plot tropes, but also the cultural ones about the actors and about the fans. And it somehow really manages to point out, like, here is your eccentricity laid bare, but I love you. You know, because its treatment of the young fans on Earth is so gentle. You feel Nesmith's annoyance at them, and you see where, like, you're a 50-year-old man and you want to go home and pour a drink, and you're answering questions about the engineering vent shaft on deck 62B, and you don't want to be. And you feel that, and you see where that would be taxing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also acutely feel the other side of it when he kind of stomps on Justin Long a little and kind of ruins his thing for him.
Yeah.
It's because everyone is so fleshed out, and it's because someone took the time to inject good growth and arc into the characters. Behavior that you might not tolerate if it was a little less grounded, you tolerate. Even from Nesmith, who his friends are all sicker of him than we as the audience are, because they've been subjected to it for years.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when Rickman has a catchphrase that he doesn't like to say, that he never wants to say for fans at cons and stuff.
Right.
One of the Thermians is so inspired by him that he's devoted his life to emulating this fictional character. Rickman struggles with the idea of revealing or not how much to tell him about the truth and falsity. And it gets almost existential for a while, because they talk about, well, the warrior code of your fictional alien race isn't real, but I'm the only guy on this crew of peace-loving aliens that's fighting to defend them. So it's real to me. That's real enough.
Yeah.
You know, in the course of events, he ends up finally reciting the phrase to inspire the character.
Mm-hmm.
Rickman himself, evidently, like, it's so bought in and so perfectly executed. I mean, it's honestly, like, it's one... I have been on the edge of tearing up a little.
Let's get back to the command deck.
I'm shot.
Krellick?
That's not too bad. We'll get you to the medical quarters and you'll be fine.
It has been my greatest honor to serve with you. I have been blessed, sir.
Don't speak, Krellick.
You'll forgive my impertinence, sir. But even though we had never before met, I always considered you as a father to me.
Hammer by the sons of Warvan, you shall be avenged.
And that's why this movie also resonates, is because it's got genuine emotion and genuine gravitas to it. And that scene specifically is a perfect example, because it's not a joke, it's not played for laughs, it's not funny, it's not played for camp. It's having its own little moment, and Alan Rickman just playing it to a T. Good filmmaking. It's a great scene.
Well, and it goes back to, too, the Thermians are so... They're childlike, but they're also very enduring in pacifism. Mm-hmm. And their major cultural difference that, you know, which again is a Star Trek nod, because a lot of Star Trek races are creatures that just have one Twilight Zone difference from people. And the Thermian Twilight Zone difference is they have no real deception. That's why it literally never occurred to them that the episodes of the series were just stories. Like I said, it gets philosophical. Like, they actually kind of discuss the idea that these creatures find fiction cruel, and they feel tricked, and they feel led to false hope. Then it turns a corner, and there's like a meta narrative there where the call and response is, you led us to false hope. And then, well, historically, this is how our race becomes brave to do these warrior things. There's a surprising depth track to it. There's a surprising philosophical undertone to such a simple little movie.
That does bring me to a point, Matt, and this is a game we play occasionally on the show every now and then. We're playing with a bit of a handicap because this has already been decided, but should it be remade, or in this case, relaunched or rebooted? Is Galaxy Quest working on a handicap because it's already kind of a repolish of something that already existed in the first place?
I don't know how I feel about like a remake of it. I would like to, if it were possible, to somehow remaster it and give it slightly better effects, although they're presentable for the time.
Mm-hmm. What had been talked about for a long time is a reboot that would act as a sequel and would reinvolve the original cast. And that was being talked about as late as 2016. And unfortunately, with Alan Rickman passing away, that kind of threw a hitch in the get-along. And it has been kind of talked about and then shelved and then pulled off the shelf. And recently, as recently as the summer of 2017, so last summer, it was back on for an order at Amazon and somehow would incorporate the original cast. Now, I don't know what that means, if they're going to pull cameos or if this is intended to be a parallel or a sequel property, but that is currently, at least as of right now, being talked about as being a thing. I think I'm a little more open, maybe not necessarily to Galaxy Quest proper, because, I mean, this is, it's hard to say that this was kind of a holy thing for me, because obviously I let it hang for several years, you know, it can't be that sacred to me, but it almost doesn't need it. It almost kind of functions well enough as it is. And, you know, you figure another bite of that apple, they might not get the balance right again and it might fall on its face. But the fact of the matter is because it is kind of already a redux, you almost have to grant them that kind of pass. You know, it is in and of itself kind of a remake of things that we held sacred and loved once before. They just changed enough of it that we're letting them get away with it. And so, yeah, it's kind of weird, but I've almost adopted Star Trek as being so ingrained in pop culture that it's almost kind of fair game at this point. Like, another good example of this is Archie Comics, which in and of itself actually just had a very successful relaunch by Mark Waid. It's really good. And you also see Riverdale on Netflix, which is Archie meets Twin Peaks. And you look at the history of Archie Comics and the different times and places where Archie has crossed over with, and I kid you not, I'm not making any of these up, Kiss, the band, the Punisher, the comic book character, the Predator, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I mean, the list just goes on. And it's because Archie is this very whitewashed, but very iconic, almost blank canvas on which you can hang crazy stuff. I think right now there is a crossover going on between Betty and Veronica and Harley and Ivy from DC. And so it's like, okay, it's an Elseworlds tale, so we'll just take this property that you are so familiar with and so know that you don't even have to have read these comics as a kid to know that there is a love triangle between Betty, Archie, and Veronica. And so they can use that to kind of hang other things and make other commentaries. Another popular one is Afterlife with Archie, which is the Archie zombie apocalypse book that's going on. And I think Star Trek is entering that same realm now. And I think a couple of examples that we're going to have in our if-then portion really illustrate that. Star Trek has almost become kind of the blank canvas that remix artists are, you know, it is Apache. It is the song that everybody's going to remix and put into their next song.
Should we segue to
Let's do that. So originally, when we pitched this episode, we had pitched it as pairing it with Spaceballs and kind of talking about what are the contrasts, why does it work here, and why does this work and this work, and they're two different approaches. And I think that could have been an interesting episode, but unfortunately it got shelved back when we were talking about it. And in the interim, we have actually had a lot of movement in the Star Trek and Star Trek adjacent worlds. We've had another Star Trek film come out with the Chris Pine cast. There is another Star Trek television series that just started this year. And then also we have these two projects that we want to talk about that are Star Trek remixes. Some of them that I wanted to call out, we actually put out a call for what are your favorite Star Trek clones, derivatives, parodies, knockoffs, good, bad, or indifferent. And we threw this up on Facebook and included some pictures. Some of them were controversial choices. That was done intentionally. But overwhelmingly, people said Galaxy Quest. That was their favorite. That was the one that they keyed into. Other examples were Pigs in Space was a favorite. The SNL skits that were done with Star Trek, famously one including John Belushi. There were some mentions of Babylon 5 and how Star Trek derivative that was, or Firefly and how Star Trek derivative that was. But Galaxy Quest, by and large, took the cake. Two of them that came up, and Matt, you watched one of these. I was able to watch both, although I was only assigned one. And the two most recent examples, I want to bring up The Orville on Fox. Now, Matt, you didn't get a chance to check this out, right?
I actually did get to watch just episode one.
Honest to God, when I saw the trailers for this, it's the project from Seth MacFarlane, who has traditionally brought us Family Guy and American Dad and some stuff that, if you're a fan, that's fine. I'm just not a big fan of anymore. And so I was really kind of hemming and hawing. And the overall look of The Orville is so similar to Galaxy Quest that I thought that maybe The Orville had become the repurposed TV show that they had been working on before. Although I don't believe that's the case. But Matt, as much as I went in with super low expectations, I'm not a big fan of Seth MacFarlane or his humor. This is a Star Trek parody that really, really worked for me. I think it's because, once again, it's done with a lot of love. And really, the only thing that separates this from being a straight Star Trek show is that occasionally, I've only watched 3 or 4 episodes, but as the episodes go, these beats come less and less frequently where they just throw in a ribald joke or a pop culture reference or a Family Guy joke is basically what I'm getting to. And so what we're dealing with basically with The Orville is we have a Star Trek setup. It's an intergalactic fleet in humanity's future. But what we have removed from the equation is kind of the poise that Star Trek had. All of the characters were humans and people, but they were also better than all of us. They didn't use money. The bridge was a melting pot of races and cultures, and nobody judged anyone. And the problems of humanity were reflected in their dealings with alien species. The Orville hasn't really taken that tack, in that what we're supposing with the Orville is that the human race has advanced in technology, but we're still in an arrested development culturally of where we're at now. And so people are still talking about poop, and people are still getting drunk and showing up to work hungover, and people are arguing about marital infidelity. And so that's a part of it that makes it what it is, but it's the part I'm least interested in. However, it does everything else so well that I hang with it.
I would say the elevator pitch on the Orville would be, what if a sitcom happened on a Star Trek ship? So right away we get the drunken buddy. Seth MacFarlane is estranged from his wife, who is also in the fleet and is assigned to his ship. And so it's very much like if you took a sitcom conceit and set it in Star Trek. Now, Seth MacFarlane is a very polarizing talent. Seth MacFarlane himself, like in person, when he hosts things, which is projects like Other Than Family Guy, he can be kind of a hoot. I don't know what you'd call him. The tone is really weird because it is scatological. It's sometimes fairly profane, but there's a weird sincerity underlying the Orville.
And I will say this, they nail the timing and the tonality and just the overall technical styles behind some of those 90s Star Trek shows, the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. There are moments in here where you see the wide establishing shot. There's the slow swell of music as the camera sweeps into our main characters who are poring over electronic devices that we don't understand and muttering technical babble. And then they just kind of segue into, your problems with the captain are thus. And they start the scene. And there's moments like that in Orville that are almost just page perfect out of Star Trek, that it gives you a little charge. It's like, ooh, I remember this, you know?
I got what I needed to out of it. I actually kind of liked it. I'll probably watch more of it.
And I will too. And I will say there's I think it's episode 3, which obviously you haven't watched, but it's an episode where they tackle a major social issue and a very complex social issue. And they actually give deference to both sides pretty damn well. And while I left the episode and I said, huh, that was really interesting, and I can't believe they went there, I don't remember a single poop joke. I'm sure they happened, but it's not what left with me. You know, it's not what stuck with me.
Well, my relationship with MacFarlane outside of Family Guy is, like, I'll concede Family Guy's played out, right? Uh-huh. But I actually, like, the longer American Dad has gone on, the weirder and stranger it's gotten.
Yeah.
And it's probably the best of those three animated series he's done. There's a lot of direct Star Trek and sci-fi references in American Dad. And MacFarlane is a guy that, even if you don't really like his sense of humor, he is a real fan, and he's a fan that gets to play in the real thing now. Honestly, that's what I liked about The Orville, is there was that real speaking of Futurama, they're going through all this stuff in their personal life, like him and his buddy. They really like being in the fleet. And you could, there's that sense of when Fry goes, yeah, but now I'm a delivery guy in space. Like, it really does come through a little bit. Not only is the character happy that no matter what else is a show in his life, he does get to fly a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
You can also tell that whatever else people think, even if it's in a parody or whatever you'd call it, a meta narrative, McFarlane really gets to sit on the bridge of a spaceship.
Right.
The other thing I really was unexpectedly charmed by in the Orville is the surrounding cast.
Yeah, it's a like good ensemble.
The big alien guy that he's obviously a jab at Worf.
Yeah.
But like his race, we're informed his race is all male, and a few other little just kind of funny takes on, like I said, the Star Trek race where one thing is Twilight Zone different.
And that's what comes up in episode 3. It's a gender identity episode involving that character. And so it's a cheap throwaway joke. We are all boys and we are large, bulky men, and you're supposed to imagine us loving each other like this. And that kind of sat wrong with me for a while. I'm like, well, that's not the most progressive joke you could make. But then they went somewhere with it. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, and then the helmsman or whatever, the guy that's just like, yeah, I just work here.
Yeah.
I don't want to get caught up in any of this stuff. I just fly it. You know, very, very much the Ron Swanson. I worked with a man for 9 years. We barely spoke. I still don't talk to him sometimes. He was my best friend.
Yeah. The other one we wanted to talk about is the recent Smash series that's on Netflix, Black Mirror, which I believe was originally a BBC offering and might still be BBC distributed over in England. But Black Mirror is kind of, it's an anthology series, and I want to say it borrows from The Outer Limits more than it borrows from Twilight Zone, but the stories in Black Mirror are definitely Twilight Zone darker than your standard Outer Limits episode. So it's a pretty good marriage of both of them, but it's one of those anthology series where one-and-done episodes, they're basically short films. Black Mirror's kind of take on it, that the it's Die Hard but blank. It's the Twilight Zone, but it all deals with man's interaction with technology and the ways in which those things can go horribly wrong. There is an episode in the latest season here that deals heavily in classic Star Trek and once again makes its points and uses that framework to kind of make its point. Name of the episode is the USS Callister, directed by Toby Haynes. This, this was good. I really, really liked this. I almost wanted to do a full episode on just this episode.
First off, let's start with the weird dual role played by...
By Meth Damon.
Yeah, Meth Damon. Who was in both Black Mirror and Black Mass. That's why I was... And Breaking Bad. He's got a B problem.
Yeah.
Jesse Plemons
is who we're
name.
Talking about, yeah.
Speaking of getting into the business, oddly, like just a career built on being like a dark side version of a more established guy.
Yeah. Well, and he's even got shades of Philip Seymour Hoffman going on. Like, if you were to throw Matt Damon and Philip Seymour Hoffman in the blender, you would get Jesse Plemons out as a delicious smoothie.
Well, and in this, he essentially, it's the same character, but physically he plays two people. He's the real life and VR avatar of a character.
Mm-hmm.
So he's convincingly physically different. It's kind of a weird nesting of things because it gets into fan toxicity, but not in the stocky sense, more in the exploitability sense.
Yeah, basically what we're looking at by way of synopsis is Jesse Plemons plays this billionaire tech industrialist, although he's kind of on the nebbish.
His partner, James Walton, is played by Jimmy Simpson, and they fall down on the Steve Wozniak, Steve Jobs divide.
Yeah, definitely.
One of them is the tech head, and one of them is the corporate operator.
And this company's claim to fame is they've basically developed a fully intermersive virtual reality, kind of on a Ready Player One level. They're scrambling to get a new patch and the new part of the system ready before Christmas, and Jesse Plemons is basically falling victim to that holodeck associative disorder that they talk about in Star Trek every now and then, where he's becoming more invested in the virtual world than he is in the real world. And Jesse Plemons has basically set up his own version of the game, his own server, where he has built a Star Trek adjacent fantasy based on an old fictional science fiction show. And he has taken DNA from all of his coworkers using, I guess, genetic memory, is able to transfer their physical being and likeness, as well as all of their memories up until that point, upload them digitally into this virtual world. And he essentially kidnaps them and holds them hostage, independent AIs, as self-aware AIs, and forces them to interact his science fiction fantasies.
Speaking of Brannigan, he's rather Brannigan-esque in his tendencies in the game. And then what happens is an attractive young female programmer is hired, and he likes her in real life. And then this is our introduction to the digitization process, because we think he's going to make a move in real life. And instead, he just takes some of, I think it's a bottle she drank out of or something, and uses it to clone her into the game. When first introduced, the entities in the game have to be told that they're not real. And so there's this enormous kind of sit-down talk they have. And then it turns out we get shades of I have no mouth and yet I must scream, because we find out that if the people are non-compliant after being introduced, he does various things to them. At one point, he removes the mouth and nose of the girl and lets her starve for air because nobody can die. So he's just like, I could just leave you like this forever. Very chilling. And then we find out that the aliens and stuff that have been attacking them on the other planets are introduced characters that didn't comply. So he just mutated them into an alien and dropped them on a random planet to come back and fight later. It's this bottled up world within a world that plays on Star Trek tropes. And then the new girl is a kind of fairly brilliant hacker, and she tries to find a way out. And so there's a techno narrative in it, along with the real world and Star Trek world plots.
Well, and on top of that, it's got shades, speaking of Twilight Zone, on the episode It's a Good Life, where Billy Mumy had psychic powers and would send you to the cornfield if you misbehaved as a child, you know. And so it's got a lot of legacy to it, but it's like I was saying, it took the Star Trek framework and hung something else on it and is stronger for it. And still functions as a Star Trek kind of send-up or parody or an homage or what have you.
Like, and here where the homage kicks in here is definitely, first and foremost, visually. The bizarre appearance and treatment of the Infinity is the name of the game. But the scenes that happen in Infinity are just this really gorgeous kind of vintageization. And it's like super saturated, kind of weirdly grainy. And then oddly sort of lit and structured. And it's very convincing and kind of just worth watching once for the visuals. And then it's one of those things where like the set of character turns here are like, at first he's real sympathetic. You get this impression that, technically he's an equal partner. And he's kind of Milton the Stapler guy. He's constantly being kind of dicked with by his coworkers, and I own half the company, you know. Very much kind of a put upon guy.
Somebody is taking specific orders for coffee, and they will forget his.
Well, first off, we find out that the women warning each other about him are right. He is creepy. He wants to clone them and do horrible things to the clones, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we also learn that he's very professionally distracted by playing Infinity and is no longer good at his job. And then we learn that he's kind of a burden on his ostensible friends. And then we learn he's extremely cruel to these poor beings that live in his computer. And so it's like, by the end of it, you really see him as like just a shambles and you don't flinch much from the ultimate thing that happens to him, which is pretty terrible. Like,
yeah.
Not to spoil it.
Well, and I think that's a little bit of fan commentary. I think that's, you know, when people are making the arguments that they've been making, that and I have to confess, I made this argument once upon a time before I changed my mind. But like, oh, they're nerds. They're not socially conscious. They're bad at interaction anyway, and we're kind of holding them to an unreal standard. No, this guy is not just a nerd because he's socially awkward. He is genuinely predatory. We're not talking about socially awkward people. We're talking about predatory people.
That's what's brilliant about the episode, because it is an exercise in your sympathetic inner narrative versus how you actually appear. And so, like, in his sympathetic inner narrative in the first third of it, the secretary's mean to him because his card's not renewed. You know, the new girl kind of dismisses him, and then he overhears the other another female employer warn her about him. And you're like, oh, wow, they're the mean kids. They're kind of mean to him. And then you start to realize, like, no, wait, he's a rich white millionaire. The reason the secretary was mean to him is because he wants to be exempt from all the policies about when you restart your card. And you realize, like, oh, she's half his age. She works for him. She worships his work. Now he's going to try to exploit her.
Right.
And, like, it really turns that corner and really connects the dots for you and makes you go, like, no, he's not being picked on because he's not getting what he's not entitled to. If he wants that stuff, he should blink 3 times, turn his computer off once in a while, and interact with his neighbors. It really makes that a thing by the end of it.
We have probably celebrated these enough, and we are horribly over on our record. But Matt, any last thoughts on Galaxy Quest or any of our recommendations today?
For sure, if you've never seen Galaxy Quest, you owe it to yourself to watch it. It's really great. And then I would say Black Mirror is actually so dark. Like, I don't think every person should watch every episode of it.
You know, I'm with you. And that's actually why I have not fervently... Well, I take that back. I haven't watched all of Black Mirror because I watched the first several episodes and I'm like, this is really good. This is up my alley. But it's also a finite resource. I think the first season is only 3 episodes long. And so I'm like, oh, this is something I'm going to have to kind of take my time with and savor. But at the same time, it's good to do that because it is a dark show. You need a little palate cleanser afterwards. When I am so glad that I watched The Orville after I watched Black Mirror, because
and the other thing is unrelated to outer space, the first episode of Black Mirror is really troubling.
Yeah.
Like it's
so anyways, folks, that's about going to wrap it up for us here at the Nighthawks Cafe. You can find us on Facebook at Nighthawks Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at Nighthawks Pod. Be sure to subscribe and leave us a review, leave us a rating. You can do that on iTunes. You can do that on Stitcher. You can do that through many, many other podcast platforms. And you'd be doing us a big personal favor if you do. And as always, you know, the best promotion is always word of mouth. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, let your friends know.
One quick Star Trek or sci-fi parody. One quick sci-fi parody that we didn't discuss.
What's that?
The Syphil and Ollie version of Spiders from Mars.
And now we did.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Rock facts. Rock facts.
All right, Matt. Well, I think that's about going to do it for me. Are you ready for coffee and pie?
Yeah, it is, after all, almost the end of the show.
It is. So, see you, folks. We're going to sign off because it's almost morning.
That was a hell of a...